KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd,
don't you understand?
Hey,
I'm
Ray!
Good to see you, man.
How you doing, man?
Well, I'm hot and sweaty, man. It's been the heat wave here, and I just pedaled my bike up the hill, but I'm fit. I'm ready to go, man.
Fantastic. That's right. We are recording this in June, and this will be months ago. There was, well, as you listen to this, months ago was that huge Northwest heat wave bubble. Where temperatures reached Portland, what, 113, 114 degrees?
Crazy. My daughter lives down there, you know, our social media manager, and Karina, and she survived it, man. But, geez, that's what's cool about this podcast is, you know, we time travel, and this would go back in time, and then
yeah.
We time shift when these things are broadcast, and then they're rebroadcast on radio, so it's all a little time capsule. But here we are now, Dave. Anyways, Dave, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm excited because months ago I took my trip to Alaska, which is really in about a week from now.
Wait.
Ray, we had so much fun, didn't we?
Wow, we did. We're going to. Well, yeah.
We're going to, but I haven't been there yet.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to go there.
Our fossil adventures, they were magnificent.
And what about you? Any paleo news happening?
There's been a lot of paleo news, man. A lot of paleo news. There's my our good friend, Pat Druckenmiller, and his colleague, Greg Erickson, published a paper. And we're going to have to get Greg on here because we wanted to talk about polar dinosaurs. They published a paper showing that dinosaurs in the Cretaceous of the far north of Alaska, where I've been on the Colville River, there's like a nursery. They have clear evidence that not only were there dinosaurs up there, but they were overwintering and they're having little babies and they're wintering, you know, I mean, spending 3-4 months in darkness. So we got to talk about that at some point.
Well, Kat, I've got a question. Yeah, they found all these baby bones and stuff, but how do they know that the dinosaurs didn't migrate in the summer, have their babies, and then migrate south?
Well, I think we should ask a guest about that because
you don't know.
That's the simple answer is I've learned I can't BS my way out of these things.
It was in the main news feed worldwide, and I think it was surprising that they said dinosaurs pretty much were at such a high, cold, chilly latitude. What was the ecology like back then? Was it warm and tropical, or was it freezing cold?
It was warm and tropical because I've been there.
Right.
There were large trees. There were actually large trees at the far north. But whether or not, you know, if you've got 3 months of total darkness and you're tilted away,
it's going to get chilly.
It's going to get chilly. So, you know, but I never drew my polar dinosaurs in the snow, man, because Kirk Johnson said, no. There were no polar ice caps then. So,
right. All right. Make a note, we're going to interview Greg Erickson, who co-wrote that paper with Pat Druckenmiller.
Yep.
All right, I'm excited today, boy. Have we got, now, I don't know if we're even going to go paleo today because...
I don't know if we are or not, but actually when I wrote our guest, our esteemed guest, our insanely cool guest,
who is?
Identity.
Right. Why do you do this every time?
I just imagine that we have like some curtain and there they are and the audience is like... But I guess it's all over, you know, we say who's in the episode. It's Brian Scarry, National Geographic photographer. I had the honor and privilege to hang out with him one afternoon. We had drinks.
Oh, really?
And he just had a whole series of films that have been on Disney Plus channel, The Secrets of the Whales. Anyways, I looked at his Instagram feed, and his most popular one, at least recently, is a baby beluga.
Right.
You guys love a baby beluga. And it's a cute little beluga just swimming right toward the camera, just newly born, almost fresh out of the womb.
For those of you who don't know, beluga is an Arctic white whale. It's a white whale. It's the only true white whale.
It's just a true white whale, but actually the babies are brown. So
yeah, they come out brown.
Yeah. So.
But this Disney Channel, the whales documentary, it is phenomenal footage. He's underwater filming them, and oh my goodness.
3 years it took, and actually it's on the cover of, you know, the National Geographic magazine, the...
Wait, what are you holding there?
Well, this is National Geographic magazine from April.
I'm tired of talking about us. Let's talk about Brian Scarry.
Let's get him on the phone.
Let's get him on the phone.
Call him. Hey, David, meet Brian Scarry, internationally known National Geographic photographer, filmmaker, and storyteller. Brian, it's so cool to see you again. We were just talking a little bit before the show. I ran into you at the streets of Ketchikan, saw you in Seattle. But meet David, my buddy, on this podcast.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
Hey, Ray, and hi, David. Great to meet you as well. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great. I can't believe the volumes of your work and photography and the amount of hours you've spent outdoor, under the ocean, above the ocean. It's just phenomenal. But I have a very kind of an interesting question. We kind of think we know the answer. Are you by any chance a paleo nerd?
Well, I am.
You know, yay.
Well, you said so in an email, but are you really?
But right? How? How and why?
Well, only from the standpoint of that I'm fascinated with paleontology. I love fossils. I love, you know, ancient realms. I love looking at Ray's paintings of such things. When I was a kid, I used to have a rock collection. So every week or so, I would have my parents take me to the local gem and mineral store, and I would buy rocks, you know, geodes or tiger's eyes or amethysts or all kinds of things, barite roses. But one of the coolest things I ever got when I was a kid was a trilobite fossil. And I still have it. I actually gave it to my daughter, who's 17 now, and she's got it in her bedroom. But I still go in and look at it, you know,
that's
every
Ray's
so often.
That's spirit animal, the trilobite.
Got one right there on my arm.
Oh,
man.
Look at that.
My first trilobite, my first tattoo, Brian. So, Brian.
Very cool.
So, yeah, we have a few mutual friends, but also I was reading through your books and I was reading your biography a little bit, and you fell in love. You said it was love at first sight, but it was the ocean that you fell in love with. So as a kid, you were lived not too far from the ocean, but you fell in love with the ocean.
I did for sure. I didn't live super close to the ocean though. I grew up in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And I lived about an hour away. I was in a little landlocked town, a textile mill town, where there were woolen mills and textile mills. And, you know, it was an old manufacturing blue-collar town. I grew up, working in those mills myself after high school or football practice.
So this is the late 1800s?
Yeah, that was a
when they employed children in the textile mills?
That's right. I tell you what, it felt like that. These mills hadn't changed since probably the 14th
century. This is in Worcester?
It was in the Worcester County area. That's
my
right.
My sister lives in Shrewsbury. Shrewsbury.
Oh, yeah. Well, not far from Shrewsbury at all. I was in a little town called Uxbridge.
All
but
right.
My parents would take me to the beaches of Rhode Island and New Hampshire, Maine, Cape Cod in the summertime. And I absolutely fell in love with the sea as a child. You know, I think I loved the notion of adventure. I grew up watching the old Cousteau documentaries and reading National Geographic, but I wanted to do many things. You know, this was the 60s, and I dreamed of being an astronaut or being Tarzan out in the jungles or, you know, whatever it might be. But there certainly was something particularly special about the ocean. I remember coming home at the end of those days, you know, in the back seat of the station wagon and all sunburned and salty.
Oh, yeah,
and,
no, I'm there with you, man. Yeah,
you know that drill,
me
right?
Too.
And having this this mix of feeling. On one hand, you know, I was at peace. I was very content. But on the other hand, my mind was sort of racing about what was underneath those waves. You know, what could I find if I could put on a tank and go explore?
Wow.
So you decided you were working in the mills. You were a corrugated box salesman there for a bit.
Yes,
and,
I saw that.
You went to Worcester State University, WSU. I went to another WSU, by the way, Washington State University. But
Wow, yeah.
But I know that you began to go to you picked up photography and you took that camera underwater. And there's an interesting connection, a mutual friend of ours, with Bill Kurtzinger and a certain pirate ship wreck.
Yeah.
That I was reading about in your beautiful book, Ocean Soul. You credit Bill with kind of giving you your big break.
Yeah, no question about it. So what you said is exactly true, Ray, that, you know, I knew from an early age that I wanted to explore the ocean. Initially, that's all I thought I wanted to do was just explore and discover. Started scuba diving when I was about 15 years old, and it was maybe a year or two after that I was attending a dive show in Boston, the Boston Sea River Show, the longest running show, dive show in the world, still going on today. And as a teenager sitting in that audience, I saw photographers and filmmakers presenting their work. And I often describe it as an epiphany. I remember saying, that's how I want to explore the ocean with a camera. But, you know, I came from this little town. Again, as I said, my parents didn't have a lot of money. I wasn't able to get on a plane and fly anywhere. I didn't have the resources to buy fancy equipment. So I chipped away at it. I worked on charter boats in Rhode Island, shipwreck diving boats for no pay. I was just doing that to facilitate going diving. I would be in the wintertime under the hulls of those boats with grinders, you know, grinding the hulls in the snow and doing all of that for free. Wow. Just so that come summertime, I could go diving for free. So, you know, I sort of cut my teeth on North Atlantic wreck diving and doing some marine life photography. And from the very beginning, my dream was to work for National Geographic. That was sort of the Mount Everest. But there was three underwater photographers working there in those days, and they all seemed very well established, didn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon.
There was Bill, David Dubilet, and who was the other one?
And Flip Nicklin, who was kind of a whale photographer. But I mean, Bill had done that too, of course. But Bill's work really spoke to me. There was something very special. He published a book in the late 70s called Wake of the Whale.
Yes, yeah,
it was a large format book. Yeah. And I remember buying that book. I think I was in a Barnes & Noble or whatever the bookshop was at the time. And I saw it, you know, prominently displayed there. And I bought it. And I remember coming home and just couldn't take my eyes off it. His photos and the stories that were written in there. It was Ken Brower was the writer. And, you know, he was relating these stories of Bill being in Hawaii or being in Antarctica or in the Arctic. And it stirred my soul. It truly did. And to this day, I still have that book sitting on the bookshelf. It's all, you know, dog-eared and waterlogged. I think I read it in the bathtub when I was a kid. You know, I did all of this stuff.
Did you stop Bill Kurtzinger? What'd you do?
Well, I certainly would have. I might have actually a little bit, but he didn't know it. And, you know, I actually, that organization that I saw that first dive show, the Boston Sea Rovers, they used to have a lot of diving notable people come through every year. And I ultimately became president of the Boston Sea Rovers, and I was running their nighttime show. So I got to meet a lot of people. I met Dubilet, I met Cousteau, I met, you know, all these very famous divers and photographers. But Kurtzinger was the guy I never actually met until quite a few years later. And we were both in Florida at a dive convention, the DEMA conference or DEMA show. And I got to meet him. And, you know, it was like, you know, if you're a baseball fan, you're meeting Babe Ruth or something. And it was just over the moon. He was very nice. And we struck up a friendship. And I ultimately had a picture published in National Geographic. It was a very rare fish called an oarfish.
Oh,
it was the legendary.
Yeah, we were going to ask you about
serpent.
That.
I was warming up to that, man.
Get into it. Describe an oarfish, because they've been washing up on beaches lately, especially out in Florida, I believe.
No,
really?
California.
Okay. Was that California?
Baja.
Anyway, they're massive. Describe it.
Yep. So, well, the story is that I was in the Bahamas just on a dive trip myself to do some photography, and I was out at a place called the Autech buoy. It was a buoy that the U.S. Navy anchored out in the Bahama Trench, the tongue of the ocean, very deep water where they did submarine testing. And the water there, I don't know, it was probably like 18,000 feet deep or some extraordinary number. But it was very, very deep anyway. And I was photographing silky sharks, and mahi-mahi, Dorado, were coming in. And on that dive, I also saw a blue marlin. But it came up, it was chasing a little yellowfin tuna, and then it saw me, and it jackknifed and swam away. So I was all bummed out that I didn't get a picture of the blue marlin. And then out in the distance, I saw this thing that I had no idea what it was. It was about 10 feet long. It was maybe 3 or 4 inches wide, laterally flat. It was shiny silver. And from a distance, I thought it was some sort of fishing lure that was being dragged by a sport fishing boat. But I didn't hear any boats. So curiosity got the best of me, and I swam out after it. And as I got closer, I could see it was a living fish, but it was oriented vertically in the water column, and wow. It had these two very long monofilament thin appendages, you know, that are called pelvic rays.
Yep,
and so it looked like a cross almost. And the
so you're saying the tail was aiming at the bottom and the head was aiming to the surface?
It's sitting in the water like a pencil, Dave.
Right.
Just pointing straight up.
Wow.
Right, and it had a crest on its head like a bird and these really big eyes. So I suspected it was a deep water animal, but I didn't know what it was. So as I got closer, it rotated those pelvic rays alongside its body. So it was all sort of hydrodynamic. And it just sank perfectly in the water column, like somebody dropped a sword. It was shiny silver. So I think I got three pictures, one of which was the better one. And I sent it to National Geographic. After doing some research, I thought it was an oarfish. And they came back. They sent it to a researcher at William and Mary University. And he said, it is the first picture of a living oarfish.
Wow.
So they published it. It became a big deal in ichthyology world.
Dude, I remember seeing that picture. I did not know that was yours. That rocked my world. And I've tracked down oarfish over the years. Have you read there's the great Tyson Roberts, I think, is the guy who's oarfish fanatic in the world. His theory is that they shed their tails. Did you know this?
Oh, wow. No, I didn't know that.
That they actually get to like 40, 50 feet long, and then they shed a tail, and they start growing, and then it's just the head.
First
one to see one. No, I'm not making that up, man. I'm not making that up. And because of this interview, I'm going to have to.
Yeah.
Tyson was after me to do the picture for his book on them.
Oh, definitely.
But you got the first photo. Does Bill tie into this story?
Well, yes, he does, only from the standpoint of me stalking him. So I wanted to stalk him, but I never actually met him until I met him in Florida. And then, you know, maybe a year or two went by. The picture was published first in National Geographic in 1996 in the December issue, and the phone rings, and it's Bill Kurtzinger. He calls me and says, Brian, I saw that picture. That's amazing. And we started talking, and we, you know, got to know each other a little bit better. Lo and behold, I was doing a trip to Australia to photograph whale sharks and great white sharks, two separate locations. And I said, Bill, you know, I got a spot open if you'd like to join me. He was doing a tiger shark story for the magazine. So he said, well, I'm going to be in Australia. Let's coordinate. So anyway, he joined me. And then we did another trip to the Bahamas to that very spot where I saw the oarfish. Didn't see another one, but it was a good trip. We had fun and we became good friends. And then one day he called me and he said, look, I've got two stories that I'm doing for National Geographic, one that I want to do and one that I don't want to do. And he said, the one I don't want to do is the shipwreck story, and it's a pirate shipwreck. And he said, you know, I was out there, I don't know, a year ago, and there's nothing there. The visibility is absolutely horrible. But if I don't do it, they're going to find somebody else. So if you want, he knew I was doing a lot of shipwreck photography in those days. He said, I will refer you. But he said, look, keep in mind that with National Geographic, you're only going to get one chance. If you blow it, they're not going to come back to you. And I think with this story, you've got a 98% chance of failure.
He is kind of he's a doom and gloom guy, but
So I thought about it for about 2 seconds, and I said, "Well, that's okay. I'm doing a lot of shipwreck stuff, and I think I could probably pull it off." So he referred me, and they looked at my work, and they said, we'll give you a shot, and they sent me out there, and pretty much everything Bill said was true, but they started to find sections of the hull. They were using these mailbox devices on their propellers to blow away the sand. It was a pirate shipwreck, sank in 1717.
The Wida Galley.
The Wida, yep, that's right.
Oh, Wida.
Wida. Wida, Wida.
Yeah, anyway, and, you know, I figured out ways to get photos. I brought down these 1,000-watt cable lights run from generators instead of using my strobes to reduce the backscatter, and I was using negative stock film instead of slide, which gave me a little more latitude, and I did macro pictures. I found, Spanish
doubloons. You knocked it out of the park.
We got it. But it was a co-credit. So Bill had done a lot of the artifact pictures, I did the underwater. So I shared my first published story with Bill in National Geographic.
How deep was this wreck?
It was very shallow. It was maybe 30 feet. Maybe a little deeper. Yeah,
that's crazy.
Wow, that's a cool story. I just talked to Bill yesterday in preparation for this.
Oh, wow.
He says hello. I did a coffee label for he's doing coffee, but you'll be pleased to know he's got a major exhibit that he's doing in Port Townsend next month.
Awesome.
So,
yeah. Oh, that's so great. Bill continues to inspire. I mean, he's done so much in his life, and he's always been a pioneer. I always look to him.
What kind of camera and equipment were you using at the start of your career? Because digital didn't exist, and the housings would have to be proprietary or invented in the workshop.
Well, so you're right. I was not using digital. I was shooting film, but there were, in fact, a few housing manufacturers in the early days. I think my first housings were made by a Canadian company called Aquatica. And then I switched to an Austrian-made housing called Subal. Today I'm using something called a Nauticam. But I switched to digital in 2005, and I did it begrudgingly. I remember, sort of kicking and screaming. I didn't want to do it, and nobody was forcing me. I could have shot with a tintype, at Geographic. They didn't care. But I started to see the advantages. And the first story I did, or the first assignment I went on, it was a shark story that I proposed in the Bahamas. And I remember bringing all my brand new digital gear and all of my old film equipment with me, too, because I didn't trust the digital.
What resolution were you shooting at the start?
Yeah, those, I can't remember. Those
10 megapixel or something?
Oh, if that. Yeah, it might have been even a little bit less. My first camera was I'm a Nikon shooter, so I was shooting a Nikon D2X.
We're just talking some of the tech stuff here. I've been watching all your films, as many as I could before the interview here. Watched all the Secrets of the Whales, but I was astonished to see that, it wasn't really the old Jacques Cousteau thing with the scuba gear. You're like free diving and snorkeling with.
Yeah.
Is that really your preferred way? And it's pretty much you and a camera.
Yeah, that's right. With whales, marine mammals in general, but particularly with whales, I found that free diving is really the way to go. I mean, the scuba does make bubbles, and that tends to frighten the whales, so it's not particularly good for getting close, which you need to do. And the other thing is that even if they're moving relatively slowly, if you've got a socializing group of sperm whales and they're just sort of playing and, moving slowly, for me to keep up with them, I got to be nimble. And with a 50-pound scuba tank and a buoyancy compensator, so, even though it's limiting to have to hold your breath, it still ends up being more productive.
Is there a crew with you? I mean, they're filming you, of course, doing some of the stuff, or is there?
Yep.
Oh, you'd have to have a boat crew. You'd have to have a
right. Well, I know, but I'm just wondering, when he's in the water, are there three or four guys behind you, kind of?
It's really a good question, Ray. Not always. So just to give a little bit of context for Secrets of the Whale, so I proposed that project to National Geographic, and I started with the magazine, and where it got approved. But given the scope and scale of what I wanted to do, I knew that they wouldn't be able to afford the time in the field and sort of that effort. So I went to the National Geographic Society, and I wrote and proposed a three-year fellowship that they had never done before. They had given some fellowships or internships, but they were usually short duration. But this was the first long three-year deal. And then when I got that approved, I went to the television division and said, would you like to do a documentary film? And we turned it into four films.
Yeah.
And then I went to the book division and said, well, look, I'm doing a TV series and a magazine story, so how about a book? And we did a book as well. But with the TV component, once that got approved, I was going to be a producer, and I would be a character in it, although it was really always about the whales, less about me, of course. And they hired a production company, Red Rock Films, to manage the production. So they did, all the sausage making. They brought in all the editors and the associate producers and script writers and so forth. And we collaborated on this notion of whale culture, which was the original idea for my story.
Wow. And where does James Cameron come into it?
So Cameron, of course, is a explorer in residence at the Society.
Okay.
And I had met Jim over the years several times, and we knew each other. And then he heard about this project and he became interested. And, you know, it was perfect to have him at that executive producer level because, of course, he brings this unique set of skills. He's not only a master storyteller who can invent these fictional worlds and build the equipment to film them, but he also is a great ocean explorer, so he understands. But, you know, he was able to look at the rough cuts that were coming back, the footage, the dailies, and really shape the narrative.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay. that's
and
cool.
Help with that. So it was a real wonderful team effort. He was.
Would he see dailies and then say, yeah, but go ahead and get another shot if you can? So he'd kind of on the fly?
I don't know that it was necessarily dailies, but it was certainly, you know, looking at rough cuts or as things were being pieced together, he would say, well, you know, we need to explain this a little bit more. You know, most audience people might not even know that whales are not fish. We have to tell them that they're really there and that they're mammals. And, you know, so some basic stuff.
Tell us about the four whales you chose and why.
Mm. And why, yeah.
So first of all, again, for some context, you know, my last big whale story for National Geographic was about right whales, particularly started with the North Atlantic right whale, which is the most endangered whale in the world. And that was published in 2008. Since that time, I had wanted to do a multi-species whale story. In 2015, I did a cover story about dolphin intelligence, about dolphin cognition. And of course, whales or dolphins are just smaller whales. They are indeed whales. But I was still struggling with that narrative, and I was reading a lot of scientific publications, talking to scientists, attending conferences, and I noticed this theme of culture, the fact that within a genetically identical species, whales are doing things differently, much the way humans were doing. And that really appealed to me, and I talked to one scientist in particular, Dr. Shane Garrow, who's a Canadian sperm whale biologist who, for the last 15 years, has been working with sperm whales in the Eastern Caribbean near the island nation of Dominica. And he was the one who really made it gel for me. He explained, you know, one of his favorite things to say is that the difference between behavior and culture is this. He says, you know, behavior is what we do. Culture is how we do it. So most humans, for example, eat food with utensils. That is behavior. But whether you use chopsticks or knives and forks, is your culture.
But isn't culture also passed down? Isn't it taught?
Yes.
It's taught
it's
well.
Taught. It's both.
And they've proven that that exists within most whale communities. Now, Carl Safina, we interviewed recently.
Yes.
And he was all part of that Caribbean study as well.
Yeah, well, he went down and spent time with Shane.
Right,
that's right.
Right.
For his book, exactly. So when I heard that, I said, that's fantastic. And then he started to explain to me that the sperm whales that he's studying, he had identified over the years about 20 or 24 individual family units of sperm whales that he said all belonged to a clan because they spoke the same dialect, the same language, and that they didn't intermingle with other genetically identical sperm whales that happened to move into those waters. So when I heard this, I imagined the neighborhoods of New York at the turn of the 20th century.
Well,
the Irish and the
Italian. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I said, that's amazing. So then I started to extrapolate and look at other whales. So humpback whales, you know, the males, they have these singing competitions every year, and it's been described as the horizontal transmission of culture.
Right.
And then I looked at belugas and with orca, you know, and their feeding preferences and food and the feeding strategies and so forth. And I said, you know, this is a new way of looking at the ocean. And my hope was that a lot of my work has been focused on environmental issues. And even though this wasn't overtly about conservation, I said that maybe it could be a very powerful conservation story, because if we could get people to see the ocean through the lens of culture, it's a game changer. It changes the way we see things, you know?
Yeah, really. I mean, if you're depicting marine mammals as these intelligent creatures that have a culture that they teach their young, that basically there's not this like magic, you know, instinct. These are very specific things they must learn in order to survive. And I think one of the coolest scenes, you know, and you talked about it, is really kind of an emotional thing. Then when that orca offered you the stingray, you know?
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
That was like you're watching it, and it's like it turns to you and do you want some? You know, and
it was extraordinary.
Isn't there a precedent of orcas doing that to other orcas, and that's why it was significant during your encounter?
Yeah, Yes. In fact, they do food share. So again, for to give a little bit of perspective on this, I in that year, that happened in 2019. That was September of 2019. And I was
our birthday month.
Oh, that's right. Look at you. Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, you got a big one this year, I noticed. Yeah. Ryan.
Yep. And so I had been already that year just traveling nonstop. I started in Dominica, I was in Sri Lanka, I was in the Azores. I was in the Canadian Arctic for 6 weeks, came home for literally, I think, a day or two, and then went to New Zealand. And New Zealand was going to be, of the 24 locations or so, that was going to be my shortest trip. It was only about 9 or 10 days. And we were trying to see something that was really hard to see, these orca feeding on rays. So I was working with a researcher, Ingrid Visser, Dr. Ingrid Visser, who's dedicated her life to studying orca lives. And she put out the APB, you know, on the internet and said, if anybody anywhere in New Zealand sees orcas near shore feeding, let us know. So this one morning, we get a call. I think it was Ingrid that called me at like 6 a.m. I had the truck already packed. I was sharing a motel with the sound guy for the film. We jumped in. We drove 3 hours north, the North Island.
Is that like the Bay of Islands?
Yeah, almost in that area. Yeah, we were north of Tutukaka, up near the Bay of Islands. That's right. Yeah, and so here's this family of orca at the edge of a harbor, and they're in very shallow water. I couldn't believe how shallow it was, and they're hunting. So so Ingrid gets us into position near the orcas, and she's telling me, you know, wait. Okay, get in now. I slip into the water with the cameraman, Kenna Skole, great diver, great cameraman. This was one of the times I did have a little scuba tank on. And I start swimming towards the orca. And here comes this adult female, and I can see the stingray hanging out of her mouth. And my mind is on overload. It's like, oh, my God, I've never seen this. 40 years of diving, never seen that. And as I'm getting closer to her, she drops it. And I'm thinking, oh, I missed it. You know, I didn't get the shot, and she's going to just leave me in the dust now. So I swam down to the bottom, and I knelt on the sandy sea floor next to the dead ray now. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe she's going to come back. And then sure enough, out of the right corner of my eye, I see this giant orca, you know, this black and white behemoth moving in slowly. And she swims behind my back. I lose sight of her. She emerges on my left side. It comes out of my left side of my vision. And then she stops directly in front of me. And the ray is between us. And she's just hovering. And she's looking at me, looking at the ray, looking at me, looking at the ray, as if to say, are you going to grab that? And when I didn't
do
it.
Are you done with that?
Yeah, exactly. And she bends over and she picks it up very gently and then turns. And I'm framing it up and you get the shot. And then she turns and another member of her family comes in and then they begin to rip it apart. They, you know, food share.
Someone in your crew filmed that experience. They were behind you.
It was Kenna, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kenna Skole, who jumped in with me. And I didn't even see him. He was just there. But, you know, I was so focused on
the whale. When that all happened, did you realize, did you question, like, did she just kind of drop that? Or was that an offering? Or, you know, I mean,
you know,
was that
an
accident?
Say,
was this intentional?
I thought about that after. And I guess part of my thinking was just don't screw it up. Get the shot. The other part of me was a 12-year-old boy that was like, look at this. Yeah. I'm, you know, 6 feet away from an orca. This is awesome.
I have a question about being so close to such an amazing and huge and cognizant animal. Mm. When I've been out in the wilds where there are crocs or sharks or tiger sharks, and you don't see them, but you know you're in their environment, there have been several times in my life where I've had that feeling that something was watching me, and I took steps to get away, get out, or move out of a potential place where I was the bottom of the food chain. So I'm sure you must have had that type of experience where you feel as though, think it's an innate, something that goes way, way back in the depths of time in our lizard brain. When we know
it's our lateral line that we actually have, Dave, you know, our lateral
could
line.
Could be.
It feels that.
But you feel like you're going to be eaten. And it's unbelievable how that is. So the question is, so here you are with a massive orca, a 2 or 3 ton individual, inches away from your nose, face to face. Do you feel something? Do you feel the energy? I mean, obviously you can see through with your eyes, but you must be able to feel something.
You know, it's such a great question, David. And I have had that experience with saltwater crocodiles in Mexico. I had one stalking me, about a 9-footer, and I felt this primal fear in the pit of my stomach. You know, it was unlike anything I'd ever had. I've had it once before. I was in the South Pacific. Yep, and I it was at dusk, and I had over 60 gray reef sharks all around me, and they were coming in hot. And you know, normally with sharks, I don't have a problem. If they get a little frisky and they bump their nose on my dome port, they go away. But these guys were doing tight 360 turns, coming right back in, and behind that one was another 5, behind that was another 10, and you know, behind that I couldn't see, and they all had their pecs down, they were jockeying for position, and you feel like you're being hunted, which you are. And it was not a feeling that I ever want to repeat, but I have to say that I never felt that with orca. It was a whole different level. I would have to say, and I don't know if it was just my own sort of fantasy, but I do think that high degree of cognition that you described was evident. It's almost like this mutual respect. We're not communicating, but we are communicating. And I just never, ever felt
threatened.
So it's
theory of mine. It's I'm aware you are there, and they're aware that you are there, and we're both thinking, feeling.
Absolutely.
I think that's the obvious thing with orcas, is because it's a culturally learned thing for them not to eat us.
That's
humans.
Right. That's right.
They have to teach their young that. Like, don't mess with those creatures.
You know? Exactly right. You know, I was talking to Cameron, James Cameron, and he said, you know, Brian, many human cultures, of course, they offer food when they meet somebody. So it's very possible that she was doing that. She dropped it for you.
I think that really was
that is so cool.
That
is so cool.
Let me ask you this. Sometimes, you know, an animal is sending out sensory pings, and literally sperm whales. I was just wondering, you've been in the water with sperm whales. I've had some people tell me, I don't know if it's true, but can a sperm whale actually kill prey with those clicks? I mean, you describe, what's it feel like when a sperm whale clicks you? Tell us what a click is.
Well, let me tell you a story. Years ago in the 1990s, I spent 3 summers going to the Azores to photograph sperm whales. And this was just before I started working for National Geographic. So I was doing this on my own. And I had a day where I'd never seen any of the sperm whales, spent weeks and weeks and never had any luck. And then this one day, there's about 5 of them sort of just moving very slowly. And it's a mirror calm, glassy calm day. Blue ocean, blue sky.
Perfect conditions.
Perfect conditions. I slip into the water with my housing, and I just move way out. The boat drifts far away, and I'm out there alone, and these whales are slowly moving past me. And again, I was shooting film, so I had 36 frames and my little camera housing. So I buzzed through all 36 frames as they were passing by, and there was a mom and calf among the 5, and they sort of just moved past. And they were gone. And then the 5th whale, the last one, which I think was an adult female, part of that family unit, just sort of swam down about 20 feet or so and was just hanging out below me. So the boat was far away. I couldn't go and get another roll of film. I couldn't get another camera. And I just decided I was going to check it out and enjoy it. So crystal clear water, I'm looking down at my fins, and I swam down maybe 10 feet. And just from a distance was looking at her, all the wrinkles and scars on her body. And then she rolled over, and I came back to get a breath. She rolled over and looked at me with her, you know, one eye, and kind of started moving her tail and spun around, still below me, but she opened her mouth and then closed it and opened and closed it. And she was opening and closing her mouth, and she started pinging me with sonar, with those clicks. And I could feel it resonating in my chest. It was like in my body cavity, these very notable Morse code clicks. It was, you know, echolocation. So she started swimming towards me very slowly, but sideways and just with her mouth open and closed. And I think that's where the sound was sort of resonating. I think they can do it from their head.
Spermaceti,
well.
Yeah.
But it seemed as though the mouth, in this case, was part of that equation, and she was on her side, So, you know, again, I'd spent weeks trying to get close to one of these things. Now I've got one practically in front of me with its mouth open, and I can't even take a picture because I'm out of film. So I'm swimming backwards. I'm backpedaling, and she just is slowly following me and clicking me, ping, ping, ping. And I'm just moving. And finally, I roll over on my belly, my stomach, and I start kicking a little harder. And she's just staying right behind me. And now I'm kicking as hard as I can to swim out of back to the boat. And she's just right on my heels. Now, clearly, if she wanted me, she could have had me. But she was
You mean had you as prey or dinner or a mate?
Well, yeah, any of the above, I suppose. I had no recourse.
I read that those clicks, they can possibly see your internal organs, as though they can see it as an X-ray, because sonar, you see the external part of an object, but it's also possible you can see even deeper into a creature. Have you heard anything on that?
I have, and I think that's very true. I think that their sonar ability, their echolocation ability exceeds anything that we can truly imagine. Navies have studied it, but theirs are better than navies. So I think she probably knew a lot about me, probably knew what I had for dinner the night before, which might have been calamari, actually. That might have been the reason why. I think she was following me.
She might have been looking for squid beaks, yeah.
Yeah, but in any case, the you know, I'm waving to the Zodiac, but I don't want him to come in on a straight line because there were whales there. So he did this big arc around me, and as he got closer, I just swam and said, give me another housing, because I thought I might be able to get a picture. But by that time, she had dived a little bit deeper. She was still just hanging out about 20, 30 feet below. I could see her well, but, you know, she lost interest. But I'm convinced that she was just keeping me away from that calf.
Those clicks, I mean, it just really, I mean, you could just there, you could feel it in your body, huh?
Yeah, it's just a very loud click, like a Morse code.
Have you heard of the documentary? It just came out called Fathom about the two.
I have.
Have you watched it yet?
I haven't. I saw the trailer though.
It's just absolutely brilliant. I wish I could remember the doctor's name, but a woman in Alaska up there near St. Petersburg. She has a theory that she has been able to distinguish humpback whales, their greeting call. And she actually played that, and she did all this research, and the data suggests they all said that she said hello through a hydrophone, and they all said hello back.
It's amazing. Yeah, I think it might be Ellen Garland. I'm not sure, but in any case.
Yes, Brian is right. The film Fathom follows Dr. Ellen Garland and Dr. Michelle Fournet, both humpback whale researchers who make astounding discoveries with whale communications. It's a must-see film, and you can find a link to the Fathom trailer on our website, paleonerds.com.
You know, studying whale language is really the new exciting frontier, I think, among many in whale science. There's a new effort that just got underway by my friend Dr. David Gruber, who was given a TED Audacious Prize of like $30 million. And with National Geographic, and he and Shane Guerra, who I mentioned, are doing this multi-year project now to try to crack sperm whale language. So I actually emailed him the other day and said, so what are they saying? You know, he's been at it for like 3 months. I said, come on. And he said, they said that guy with the camera can stay back in Boston. So.
That's what they're saying. Hey, you know, speaking of amorous sperm whales, I noticed in this is not the Disney Channel. I noticed some footage where there was a large male that showed up and he had amorous ways on his mind in that one. I was like, holy cow, I've never seen that on Disney before.
No.
You must know actually a lot of the real secrets of the whales because they're mammals and they fall in love. What have you seen that we could talk about here in this podcast?
Well, I have seen some of these big males. In fact, it was in I've seen it in Dominica for sure, where a male. And again, just to give what I know about that. So these whale families are matrilineal. They are led by the older, wiser females of the group. And if there are male calves, they tend to stick around with the family until maybe age 14 or so, 13, 14. And then they swim away and nobody knows exactly where they go, but they end up usually coming back to those native waters, probably to mate and look at other families and so forth to do their thing. But very little is known about that. When the males are in the region, you hear a very distinct sound. They make a clang. So the normal sounds that you will hear when they're feeding, when the whales are down 600 meters in the prey field looking for squid, you'll hear this echolocation, this click, click, click. So they're looking for food. When they are socializing, they use these codas. It's a pattern of clicks. So, you know, the ones in Dominica that I heard, they make a pattern of clicks that's kind of like click, 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 click. And it sounds like you're at a football game, you know, dun, 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 dun. But when you go to other places in the world, you hear completely different languages, different dialects. But when the males are there, there's this very, you know, metallic clang sound that they make. So the male...
It's a macho mating call.
I think it is. I think they just show up they make their clang. And it's like, ladies, I am in the audience. I am here now. And it changes everything. I mean, you see the behaviors all change and their normal daily foraging patterns and socializing patterns all change. But I saw a giant male sperm whale in Sri Lanka. We were out there for 3 weeks in 2019 in a part of Sri Lanka that doesn't really have an infrastructure for diving or going out to look for whales. But we hired these fishing boats and we would go out every day, very long distances. And we saw some big family units, you know, maybe 30 whales or more in one of these families. But a couple of days, we saw this one giant sperm whale male, and I was able to get in the water on one day. I would say he was maybe 50 feet long. I mean, just much bigger than any of the other females we had seen, or even the juveniles. And I named him Zeus. He was all scarred up. The front of his face, the end point of his head, his nose, was flat and white. It was like he was ramming ships his whole life. It was just amazing. Wow. When I first saw him underwater, I couldn't figure out what it was. It was just solid white. It was like Moby Dick or something. And as he swam past me, he looked at me with that very soulful eye. I have a picture in my book, Secrets of the Whales of Zeus. And he was just all scarred up and, you know, the stories I'm sure he could tell. But he had previously been, when I jumped in the water, he was with two females. So, you know, he was getting busy.
Post-coital?
I think it might have been coital interruptus. Yeah. He wasn't too happy.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You're that guy.
That's right.
Now, there's another documentary out there, and I think it's called The Loneliest Whale in the World, about this frequency. This whale has been screaming this call on a particular frequency.
It's actually called The Loneliest Whale, The Search for 52. And it's a beautiful documentary about the search for a whale that has been calling out at 52 hertz, a frequency unrecognized by other whales. This film is beautiful and enlightening, and I highly recommend you put it up next in your watch list.
But their sounds can travel pretty much, they say, can crisscross the oceans of the world.
Mm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's been said that pre-industrialization, you know, before there was ship traffic,
shipping,
and ocean noise.
Yeah, shipping's the big issue.
Blue whales could potentially speak, you know, to each other across the entire Pacific Ocean basin. You know, as a sperm whale, I mean, a blue whale in Australia, say, could talk to one in California. But that doesn't happen today.
Well, you spent a lot of time here in Southeast Alaska and then chasing humpbacks elsewhere in the world. The culture of learning the bubble net feeding, one of the things I learned watching the documentary and The Secret of the Whales with the episode, the humpback episode, was that they're like old buddies. They're getting together again. They all know each other. It's like, hey, and they all, but that's a culture that learned joint bubble net thing. Kind of, right. Did it start here in Southeast Alaska and then spread elsewhere? Is that what the thinking is?
Yeah, that's my understanding. I was working with Dr. Andy Szabo, who is one of the co-founders of the Alaska Whale Foundation, and we worked off his boat, and we were out there working with the humpbacks doing the bubble net feeding. And according to Andy, if I got this right, you know, it really started some time ago. And there was just this one group of whales, you know, 10 or 12 whales that sort of figured out this way of creating this bubble net around the herring. They one whale blows the ring, and they all have different jobs. One sounds the call to begin the process. One blows the bubble net. They flash their white undersides to tighten the bait ball, and then they all rise up through. But the interesting thing is that, you know, these are the whales that spend winter in Hawaii, and there's about maybe 2,500 humpbacks that come to those Alaskan waters in the summertime, but only about 60 of them, give or take, engage in this communal feeding. It's members of different families that come together to work cooperatively to do the bubble net feeding. Now, the interesting thing as well is that recent science has been published that suggests that individual humpbacks can be and are as successful at feeding, doing the bubble net themselves, than the groups. So the question then is, why are these groups getting together every summer?
Right,
and
right.
As you said, I think it's old friends who want to have dinner
social interactions.
Totally. Let's bubble tonight.
But you said you said they started this some time ago. Now, whales have been around for 40 million years, and probably the humpback in 10 million years unchanged, basically. So is this a learned thing and recently, or were we talking, we don't know?
You know, I should know the answer to that, David. And my belief was that it has been seen for many decades, but I don't know that it goes back centuries.
Is there Native American scribblings?
Yeah, don't know about that. I don't want to say the wrong thing.
If we're talking culture, I'm betting there are things that are learned or kept for generations, and then maybe they're lost and they're learned again, you know.
Sure.
But I have seen individual humpback whales. We had one that was visiting here in Ketchikan. Phoenix was his name. He was entertaining everybody last December. He didn't go to Hawaii. But you could just watch him systematically going up and down the channel, bubble feeding all by himself.
And dolphins, some dolphins do that too in the mud.
But
right?
he was just bubble feeding, and you know, and he's just an individual doing it. But I like the idea that it's sort of a social thing. And
yes,
are they? There's males and females that bubble together.
Yeah, it sure is. And you know, the interesting thing is that some of those males that are working cooperatively in Alaska to do this feeding behavior, those are the same males that would be competing against each other for females in Hawaii. So, you know, at one moment they're rivals, the next minute they're friends. And I think there's a lot of parallels there with human society,
well,
right?
Dave and I are like that a lot. So, you know,
right,
I mean, one
right,
week
when
it's
it comes to,
good. And then
you go to dinner and have a beer, but the next week you're duking it out.
One week I'm happy and Ray's sad. The other week is I'm happy and Ray's happy. So,
but we like to bubble together, don't we, Dave?
Yeah, we do. We bubble together.
Well, that's what's matters.
I'd like to ask that question. That Ray does some incredible research prior to every guest interview, and he spends the time digging up all the dirt. But you coined a very interesting phrase as a question. And that is, what is Brian's scariest moment in the ocean?
I'm sure he's been asked. He already told us about the reef sharks.
Yeah, those two that I described, the crocodile in Mexico and the sharks in the South Pacific. But, you know, probably the most frightening things that have happened to me were not because of wildlife. It was because of my own, you know, stupidity or user.
How about heading into on the Great Barrier Reef? I'm heading home, and I look at my GPS, and I'll get there after the sun sets. And you realize you cannot navigate a reef at night, and so I had to go sit on an island and spend the night.
Oh man, yeah. Well, I got lost at sea off the coast of Ireland. It was daytime, thank goodness, but I was doing a story on ocean wildlife of Ireland, and this one day I was doing a dive off of County Kerry, a place called Puffin Island. Came up from the dive, my assistant and I, he was carrying one of my housings. I had a housing, dry suits on, cold water. But there was a very strong current, and we were getting swept out to sea. The dive boat had the engines running, so they didn't hear us yelling. There was a big Atlantic swell,
so
they couldn't see us. The sun was at our back. And lo and behold, we ended up drifting for about 2.5 hours before we got picked up by a fishing boat. So that was dicey. Another time when I was doing a harp seal story in the icy waters of Canada, you know, diving through 25-foot thick pack ice, going through these breathing holes and leads, cracks in the ice. And I, you know, the hole closed above my head.
Isn't that cold?
The wind and tide. It's very cold.
Hole closed above your head.
Yeah. So I had to find another way out. In another
wow.
exit hole. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Did you have a tank on?
Yeah. It was scuba diving, but
right.
you know,
still,
only
still
as
you
as,
only have as
yeah.
long as your pressure is.
Exactly.
And what's the weirdest thing you've ever seen in all? I mean, even unexplained. What's the weirdest thing you've ever seen?
That's a really good question. You know, that oarfish was.
No, I was
going
to say that oarfish
there.
Had to be the one. I envy you that, man. Wow.
It was a great day. Yeah. I mean, on that roll of film, I had silky sharks. I had mahi-mahi and an oarfish. And I almost had a blue marlin all on one dive.
On one roll of film. Wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, I think that what they're doing when they're fishing like that as giant pencils in the water, that, yeah, their fishing lines are basically that mane and those fins that are going out, and whatever anything bumps into that.
Yes.
They suction feed whatever's there.
So their pectoral fins are kind of like a.
They're like monofilament. They're very thin. Yeah. They're like fishing line. And I remember there was like little yellow ribbons on the end, like a lure.
Oh, they're lures. Yeah.
I think they're chemically clad. I think you're right, Ray. I think those pelvic rays, as they're called, are actually, you know, treated with something biologically that works to help them fish. Yeah.
And they do, they're related to ribbon fish, and they're in that oarfish, and then opas are actually in the same family of fish.
That's
cool
my
one.
Favorite fish. I always wanted to see one in the wild.
Tell me what an opa is. You guys are
we're suddenly fish nerding out, but opas are, well, describe them. You're on the show.
They're a moonfish, right? They're called a moonfish, and they're this kind of pinky orange with spots and sort of tall body. They're sort of I don't know. I wouldn't say teardrop shape, but somewhat like
disc.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Red fins
disc.
And polka dots. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful fish. You have swum with the most dangerous sharks in the world. You know, great white sharks, and you did a whole National Geographic series with great whites, and you did tiger sharks, and you did oceanic white tips. You're one of the first guys to shoot oceanic white tip underwater.
And makos,
those times with the sharks, you were really more worried about maybe equipment failure than the shark eating you.
Yeah, you know, I've probably done thousands of dives with sharks, and only two or three times did I feel compelled to get out of the water. It was just a bad feeling, and things were getting amped up, and I didn't feel it was safe. But, you know, contrary to popular belief, as divers, David probably knows this, I mean, you know, you don't generally see sharks, and when you do, they're usually
far
not
away,
interested.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So you have to work hard to get them close enough for a good photo.
Well, I did do the Port Lincoln Great White in the Neptune Islands.
Yeah.
Shark cage.
Isn't that awesome?
That
wild.
Was quite amazing. Yeah.
I talked to a guy once who sitting in a bar in Monterey who told me the story of being attacked by a great white shark. And he was out hunting for abalone near the islands.
Well, it's the abalone divers that are the most.
But his first thought, he was out there, and he actually had one of those little scooters that he was kind of putting along.
Yeah.
And he went, and he was out there, and suddenly he sees the big tail go by. And he goes, and his first thought was, wow, I just got to see a white shark and didn't have to pay to go see it. And he's scooting along. And next thing is he looks down and it's coming straight at him from underneath, mouth wide open. And then, of course, in the typical barroom story kind of style, he lifts up his arm and there's the tooth marks here up in his upper arm, all the way down to his leg.
He got mouthed by it like Rodney Fox.
He got mouthed, but it's because it was biting down on him and hit that little scooter thing that it let go. But, you know, a lot of people say that, you know, a great white is going to, they don't want to eat us, but, you know, they bite you and then let go. They've made a mistake. No, they're just bleeding.
You know what?
They're bleeding you, but
say that to all those Australians who have been completely eaten and witnessed,
Sure.
Well, I have shark attack statistics here, fellas.
All right. Look at that. He's prepared.
Let's hear it.
Great white sharks, 352 attacks, 52 have been fatal.
When?
That's it.
No. 1 year?
No. This is total. Total numbers.
Wow. So many shark attacks are probably bull sharks, but are not categorized as such. Would you agree, Brian?
I would. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of those attacks or bites happen in murky water. It's somebody surf casting or fishing. Yep. So that could be.
Well, they're right up there with maybe just almost as many as a tiger shark. But anyways, well, actually, one of my questions before I ask the big question.
Yeah. You mean the fun question?
Well, the fun question.
I asked the big question.
All right. Dave ends up with a big, thoughtful question at the end. He tries to. He writes them down. Even, you know, he'll read it off the script. But, you know, years ago, there was an article about you. As David says, we do a lot of sleuthing and research. But 10,000 hours underwater, easily.
Yeah.
That was years ago. You probably have maybe 15,000 hours underwater. I don't know. It's nice you to be with us above water
today. But not in a row. But
I know. But when you look at that, there's 8,760 hours in a year. You're going to be 60 years old here soonish. You spent probably close to 2 years underwater.